What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined with our Senior Editor Jessica Condit to talk about games. Hey, Jess.
Hello. Happy to talk about games.
Happy to have you here. And also, since we're talking about games, podcast producer Ben Ellman is also going to chime in about his experience with Armored Core 6.
It's Ben time once again. Ready for it.
It's mech time. It's Ben time. Thank you both for joining for this episode. So yeah, we're going to have a bunch of game news and there's some other news to dive into. I just want to say heads up, if you're looking for an iPhone preview, by the way, check out last week's episode. We had Mark Gurman on from Bloomberg and we had a really good chat. I think he even like basically gave us some details on things that I never even knew about. He mentioned a Lightning connector 12-inch MacBook that I had never heard of, even though I've been writing about, you know, Apple rumors forever. So that's a great episode. Check that out. And we're all preparing for the iPhone event next week. So stay tuned to Engadget. We'll also likely have a mini podcast right after the Apple event on Tuesday. So watch out for that. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We always love getting feedback and questions from you guys. And I want Ask Engadget to be a returning segment in the podcast. So send us your questions. I love digging into things and researching and helping people out on the show. So reach out to us, podcast@engadget.com. Jess, we've been wanting to talk with you for a while because of Starfield. Starfield is finally out for everybody. It was a bit of a staggered launch, right? It was out for, premium people who bought the premium pass or Game Pass subscribers who bought the premium expansion. I also did that and I'll talk about why I did that. But I bought that last week. And as of this week, as of this recording, it's open to everybody. It's on Game Pass. I saw your review, Jess. I was eagerly awaiting your perspective and a lot of other, you know, folks. And your title, I think, really says it all. Starfield review, you will like some of it.
So, 100%.
That seems very clear
from me to you. You will like some of it. Yes.
Can you boil down what do you mean by you will like some of it?
Yeah, I mean, I truly think that this game has enough stuff in it that everyone who plays it will eventually find some loop that they really like. You know, whether that's buying a condo on a planet and just kind of living a life there or
paying your mortgage.
No, truly though. Hey, yo, don't knock it. Okay.
I'm living that happy in real life. It's not fun.
No, like I'm having a good time living on Neon doing corporate espionage for a tech company there. And then like other people will really get into the ship stuff. Other people will really like exploring the planets. There's a lot of stuff to do. But you may have to play 10, 20, 40 hours of a game that you just kind of like to get to the thing that, you know, is actually will keep you coming back. It's not a terrible game by any means. Bethesda knows how to make a game, but it's classic Bethesda for better or worse. I have a lot of thoughts about like the narrative and the sci-fi nature of this game. So we can talk about that a little more specifically. It's a game that has something for everyone, but it's not really a coherent experience on its own, I would say. What do you think after playing? You've played like dozens of hours at this point, right?
I have not dozens, maybe okay. Up to a dozen. I've had it for a week and I normally don't have time to like dive into games, but it's just been, I've just cleared out everything I do at night and just be like, I'm going to spend some Starfield time whenever I can. So I've put in maybe 10, maybe 12 hours at this point. I will say, I also have complicated feelings about this game because I do think the sci-fi setting is so generic. I have been trying to chase the experience I had with the first Mass Effect for so long, and certainly Mass Effect 2, I think, kind of hit that really well. We just have not gotten there. Like, even the Mass Effect people couldn't make another great Mass Effect after Andromeda, or with Andromeda. I think this world is really empty. I don't get the sort of like adventuring experience I'd expect from a space game because it relies so much on fast travel to move to different places. It's really weird and inert is a word I think you used, and it just kind of feels that way for me. At the same time, I can't stop playing it. Like, yeah, it is kind of disappointing on so many levels. And I'm like, well, it's space shit. And I like space shit. And it's actually pretty decent space shit coming from Bethesda. And we should probably take a step back and explain. Like, this game is basically Fallout in space. That's what it feels like to me. It, and Fallout has typically been you in a, you know, apocalyptic landscape where you're free to do things, collect weapons, make friends, fight people, talk with people. You're doing all that, and the apocalyptic hellscape does actually exist here too. But you're also doing it in space, and you're traveling around. You're having, you know, you're having dogfights outside of planets. It's just expanding that sort of universe too. I think the scope of it is kind of incredible, but it is funny to see this game come out and be like, well, hey, you can explore the cosmos. You can do anything. And No Man's Sky is there and has been steadily getting better and better, I think, over the years, from a launch disappointment to a game that I think has so many cool things in it. And it's incredible, and you can play it in VR, and I play with my daughter sometimes just to wander around planets. It's so full of life and so interesting. This game is just not. And that's kind of disappointing to me.
Which seems really fascinating to me, because you were saying that it feels very sterile, it feels very kind of empty and things, which is the opposite of what you think about when you think about Fallout. You think about Fallout being like feeling very lived in, feeling like there is life in Megaton, and the characters, man, they pop. I haven't heard anything about really anyone being excited about any of the Starfield characters. Like they were excited about Three Dog, or like they're excited about
Pop. The writing in this game is not good. No, it just isn't.
It's bad. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. It's from the wider stories to the individual dialogue lines. You don't connect with anyone because there's nothing really to connect with. They're kind of shoehorning emotion in the main storyline at parts. And it doesn't ever ring true. But again, it's just like, okay, I'll skip this dialogue.
Yeah, just get through it.
You know, I'll do the persuasion thing. Which is sad. And I like that thing.
It's, like, I think that is sad. I totally agree.
It's sad.
It feels like
sad.
They yada a lot of the great early stuff that should be in a you know major narrative like this. Whereas this one's like, I think within 30 minutes, you're like, oh, yeah, you're very special. Yada, yada, yada. You have this connection to, oh, ancient stone. Cool. Let's go collect more ancient stones. Oh, you're very important. You're going to join the organization now. It really whisks you through a lot of things. And your character just has no sense of life or agency of their own. And the characters you're introduced to are all pretty boring. And yeah, you got to find that loop. It took me like 5 hours to be like, oh, I can actually do cool things. I can zip around. And if I see an enemy ship land near me, I could just like sneak over there and take that ship. And that was cool. But at the same time, there are these weird, like world breaking things that just don't make any sense, right? Characters at major headquarters of, you know, political organizations, just sit around waiting for you to talk to them. You know, they don't appear as if they're doing anything else. I saw people talk about this on Twitter, but there's, the president of one of those organizations. It's just the top floor, that building. You can walk over there, walk right into their office.
You don't even have to do any like quests in order to like get an access card
just
or anything
walk
like
over
that.
There. Okay. You can walk over there and shoot her in the head, you know, and there's no security there. There's no nothing. Once you start that, then yeah, everyone's like, oh my God, how did this happen? How did this very preventable situation happen? Because we had no security.
And then unfortunately, then you're trapped in a combat loop, which is not satisfying. The combat in this game is also trash. Like, straight up, it's not good.
Okay, and I was just watching some videos before we started recording about, like, the combat. And what made Fallout very satisfying is that it had, like, a kind of combination between, like, turn-based combat and, like, live first-person shooter stuff, because you had VATS, because you could stop everything and choose to shoot a certain limb or something, and maybe you'd miss, and then you'd have to figure something out in real time. But this is just like, you're kind of shooting at people and they ragdoll in the Bethesda way, and that's it?
It's not bad. I did hear stories that, I don't know if you saw this, Jess, that maybe you can unlock some sort of like time slowing down localizing feature for shooting later on.
I think
maybe a skill lock.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you gather abilities over time, right? So you do get more like kind of magical-ish powers as time goes on, and there are mods you can equip, there are items you can use that like make you move faster, whatever. But no, there's no VATS here, and then the bullet sponges that just drop in randomly, these like over-leveled random characters that you have to be like, why isn't this one dying, but this one that looks exactly the same is dying in two hits.
The and number it, it is just, higher. Yeah.
It's just really like, it's just odd. And it's not, it feels like combat did not need to be as big a part of this game as it is. And if they had maybe, if Bethesda had focused on a loop that was actually enjoyable or something innovative, anything innovative, maybe this could have been a better experience, you know, for me, for what I'm looking for. I mean, we're talking like all the games we've mentioned, like comparing this to, I specifically think this is Fallout 4 in space, right? It's Fallout 4 specifically in space. And Bethesda's been making this since Fallout 4 landed, 7 years. And this game, okay, I lost my train of thought, actually.
And Fallout 4, by the way, I should just say, was kind of a disappointment, I think, for a lot of people after Fallout 3, after New Vegas, like, which were so narratively rich and so many cool things were happening in those games. Fallout 4 was just kind of like, is that the one where Liam Neeson is your dad? Or the voice in it or something?
I don't know.
But that's exactly what people say when they talk about Fallout 4. They talk about like very specific experiences and how much they loved certain characters in Fallout 3 and New Vegas especially. Like New Vegas... Yeah. Yeah, cult hit. So, but Fallout 4 is like, oh yeah, is that the next one? Is that the one where there's like guys in tricorner hats or something? And then people are like, oh yeah, Fallout 76 also happened, I guess.
It's right. It's funny. So I think part of the problem is this game's coming out after No Man's Sky had so much time to, first of all, stumble and get a lot of criticism early on, but also those developers have doubled down and have put so much into that game. Where anybody buying that today gets such a rich and deep experience. It's so cool. You could just travel the cosmos on your Switch on multiple devices. It's like a really cool experience. And also other games like Outer Worlds have landed, which came from ex-Fallout developers, and they made a very cool, narratively rich Fallout game in space. And it's not as expansive as this. You're not going to like so many planets, but the characters are strong. The events are strong, right?
I've heard nothing but good things about the writing. Mm-hmm.
And the writing's great in Outer Worlds and Outer Wilds, by the way.
And Outer Wilds.
But that's a different game. But no, all these games we're talking about are the better version of Starfield, of the things you can do in Starfield. Everything in Starfield exists in another game in a more concentrated, more coherent form. And like if you like the exploration in Starfield, play No Man's Sky, and you're gonna have a great time. And like the thing with that is, No Man's Sky, from the beginning when it launched, it had a clear identity, it had a clear loop, it had mechanics that made a lot of sense, and they were contained, and that's why that game got better. This game is not that. This is just a AAA big world bomb that we got, right? And it's kind of expansive, but it also feels lifeless and empty. Like, I don't know if you saw that Twitch streamer that just tried to fly to Pluto or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just ended up, after 7 hours of flying straight toward it, flying through a texture as the planet. And like,
I can understand
that wouldn't happen. That wouldn't happen in No Man's Sky, because they knew what they were doing and they focused on it and they did it. And it's the same with like Destiny when it launched. Not many people were very hyped on Destiny when it launched, but it had a loop that some people were like, there it is, that's the game. And it just got better from there.
Destiny needed a sequel to get really good, right? It needed one DLC to get great. And then the sequels were, I think, a lot
but
of people
had, in. They had that focus from the beginning, and that's what people respond to, I think. Yeah.
Focus is the key word here, I'd say. But yeah, traveling around the cosmos in No Man's Sky, you feel like, oh, you're actually traveling through space. Whereas I think Starfield's thing is like, yeah, space is actually pretty boring and there's not much to do in between sequences. So there is a realism to this of like traveling for 7 hours and not really encountering anything because space is big and empty and vast.
Then we shouldn't see any stars when we're out. When I'm outside of a planet in space, we shouldn't see any star. That messed me up, because I was like, if we're actually going to do this, you want to make me feel alone, empty in space. Why do I see 1,000 stars in every frame when I'm out? That's just not how it would be. And it actually makes it feel, like more fake, more like set dressing.
More
right?
fake. Yeah. I think the thing about these games is like, you could always be like, oh, that building way off in the distance looks really cool. I'm going to walk to it and maybe something cool will be there. And this game has a lot of that, except there's just nothing there.
There's nothing there.
I've enjoyed exploring some of the planets, but it's sort of like you run into the same sort of like pirate camps or some things to deal with. There are a few great moments I had. I think early on, within 2 hours, I was able to like travel around. I had a mission that sent me to Mars. So I was like, okay, I'm going to check out the solar system, see how things are going. So I transported to Earth And you're basically fast traveling everywhere. You just in the map menu, which is terrible, by the way. I don't know what's up with the menus in this game, but everything is awful. But I was like, okay, let's go to Earth. Let's go nearby Earth and see what's up. And you get there and you're confronted with an ashen desert hellscape. And that kind of, I didn't expect that because nobody really talked about it, but I figured, yeah, sure, something's wrong with Earth. But yeah, it's just desert. No blue, no nothing. And that kind of, I did have a gasp moment there. So I was like, okay, I got to go check this out. And then I landed on Earth and it's just like a giant desert. It is, I don't know, a couple miles away from your house in Arizona, Jess. Like it just
truly
lifeless, barren. And that kind of broke my heart a little bit. Like it is sort of like this, the game isn't presenting me a storyline about this yet. I'm sure we'll have to do something on Earth eventually. But just seeing that made me very sad, especially where we are now after the hottest summer ever recorded, the hottest year ever recorded, you know, temperature wise. Jess is in the middle of a desert. I'm in a very humid zone over here. And the way we've had to survive over the past year just feels very harsh and a sign of like things to come. So seeing that barren, deserted Earth broke my heart. And I think that was a cool thing in this game. But that was like, you know, 1 minute from several hours.
Jess, you reacted differently to barren, deserted Earth. Tell us about that.
I also found moments of beauty in this game, right? There are definitely parts where I was like, damn, that looks good, even on Xbox Series S. It looks cool. And it's, yeah, you know, that was a cool scene. There is a narrative point in the main quest where you go to Earth. And it's you know, yeah, it's interesting to see the planet that way. But it's nothing we haven't seen in other sci-fi stories. I guess to me, I really do enjoy a sci-fi world that makes me think about what we're doing now, how we're living now, what, you know, what the future actually holds, like new ideas about how we might be living. And Starfield doesn't offer anything there. There's truly, I can't pick out one new idea, gameplay-wise or narrative-wise, that makes this a unique, interesting piece of sci-fi. And that's really disappointing to me. I mean, I feel like if you had 7 years to craft an arching story about the universe and humanity's place in it, the possibilities are endless, right? And we just got a lot of stuff we've seen before. And that's just disappointing. I really expected more there. I truly did. And that really let me down. It's the opposite of sci-fi to be so derivative.
Side plane.
Truly the opposite.
Yeah, it's very science vanilla. I don't know. But the thing, like, I think what we're saying, though, is, like, it gets the basics down enough where, like, okay, this is scratching an itch where I'm like, okay, I do like flying around, you know, different stars. I was like, okay, I'm going to map my way to this far-off solar system. I like seeing what alien planets look like and the way they kind of build those things. You know, in that respect, I think it's totally fine.
I'm going to say something that is going to be really disappointing to Microsoft, which is it doesn't seem like I need to participate in this Xbox generation at all then, if this is your big exclusive. So is this a big disappointment for Microsoft, or is this going to like be kind of a hit with Game Pass? What do you think?
Yep. Hit with Game Pass.
Yeah.
This is a fine game. If you're already on Game Pass, this game is landing day and date. Play it. Have fun. It's a big, expansive world that you're already paying for. Why not? So I don't think it'll be a loss because Microsoft is now counting success in terms of playtime, not like units sold, right? So as long as they have people playing 10 hours of this game, like every Game Pass user plays a few hours or up, you know, 10 hours, 40 hours, I think that's a success for Microsoft. But I don't think it portends good things for Bethesda as a studio, as its own thing inside of Microsoft.
Or even Microsoft
don't think it's
as
good
a whole. Redfall, right? We talked about Redfall, and you were also like, hey, this is a fine Game Pass game, perfectly fine for Game Pass, and that's it, you know?
But then does that contribute to the like Netflixification of video games, where
at least for Microsoft, yes,
for well, so many
yeah.
like Netflix shows or honestly streaming shows in general, there's something that feels like diet soda about them. There's something
hey, don't
that
knock
feels
diet soda. Okay,
but there's diet something that life. There's something that feels a little bit aspartame-y, a little bit like this is almost good but not quite like.
That's
really
open
excellent.
World AAA games nowadays. Like that's I think that's more a symptom of, yeah, the funding structure that allows these billion-dollar companies to be focused on the profit line. And that's how we get games focused on the wrong things, right? And that's just kind of that system. I think the Netflixification of games for now for indie studios is actually working out really well, but we have to keep an eye on it because
which is
we
to
know
say
how that
actually
goes
working
run.
For Netflix.
No, it is. No, Netflix is killing it with indie games right now. Yeah, seriously, if you have Netflix, go check out their games. Play Kentucky Route Zero, please. But yeah, it's. I do think that Game Pass has the potential to get to that point, right? But for now, I see smaller studios taking advantage of the opportunities they've been given. The AAA studios are still stuck in this rut of trying to offer us big, empty worlds full of very little to do with bad writing. And I'm pretty sick of it, personally.
Yep, totally agree. And by the way, other games that are, I think Outer Worlds was on Game Pass. I'm not sure if it's still on Game Pass, but if you have a chance, you'll probably find it on sale. If you want like the good, well-written Fallout experience, check that out.
Outer Wilds, really want to play it. It's just the port on Switch is bad, so I got to find another.
Start cloud streaming, man. That's the other thing I think that's Microsoft true. Has bet a lot on is that you just need a controller and a computer with a screen, and you could stream from the cloud to your thing. That apparently there were reports that was kind of breaking down with Starfield. Like everybody was trying to cloud stream Starfield, which is a good sign for Microsoft, but a bad sign that their infrastructure couldn't hold it. We also mentioned Outer Wilds, which is this really cool like space exploration game that is basically based on a time loop, and you're solving a mystery. There's no like, the narrative is so fascinating and cool, and you just kind of have to explore it, but also gets to really scary aspects of traveling space. Like you're basically racing against the star exploding. And I remember landing on a planet in that game where it had like 50-foot tall waves or something on the planet. Just like being in that environment kind of freaked me out a little bit. I would love to see more of that from Starfield eventually.
Okay, so let's move from a big world full of seemingly lifeless mannequins to something that's been received as a very hearty, nutritious meal. Let's talk about Baldur's Gate 3. These are two very different games. Yes, they're both role-playing, but Baldur's Gate is turn-based. It is completely based on D&D, all the way down to the fact that you're doing virtual D20 rolls. Jess, tell us more about it, because you're the only one of this trio that has actually played it.
Oh, no, I haven't played it. I'm just telling people to play it.
We all want to play it. We all want to play
okay,
it.
Okay, so here's a question. Why haven't we played it?
Well, because I play D&D, so I'm good.
Okay.
Oh, but, man, well, yeah.
But if, yeah, it, this is like, this is the game where I saw enough people loving this game that when my friends who like D&D were asking me, should I play this? I was like, absolutely, give it a go. And give Larian Studios some money. Yeah, why not?
Seems like D&D, the game, basically. It is wild that this game has been in development for so long, too, and it's coming out so close to Starfield. I will tell you guys, there are things I want to like about this, but I have not had a great experience with like PC RPGs that are based on D&D. I got into like Neverwinter Nights when that first came out. It was just like never quite hit the way I wanted to. So I think eventually I will be in the vibes. I will feel the vibe to check out Baldur's Gate 3, but I chose to go Armored Core 6. I chose to go Starfield. Like I wanted space and science fiction before I wanted, some of this RPG stuff. Plus I'm playing a bunch of other stuff, which we'll talk about. But just we can compare the kind of release of Baldur's Gate 3 and Starfield. Like Baldur's Gate was in early access for years, right? Like people have been talking about this for a while, but it was just the first chapter, right?
Well, okay. So I'm curious about, especially like Ben, your comparison points between Starfield and Baldur's Gate and why early access might be the thing there. Because in my mind, and how I see early access play out, is it's a tool for smaller developers. It's a marketing tool. It's a funding tool, mostly. It's something that you do when you need to generate more money for your game while you're building it, and also generate some hype. You know, all these things that like Starfield didn't need to do because they had millions of dollars of marketing money behind them. And they could just, develop for 7 years without running out of money. No problem. That's, for Larian Studios, the Baldur's Gate people, they went into early access because they needed funding. Like that, you know, they needed funding, they needed hype. And it worked out. And it works out for a lot of games, especially, you know, these indie games that do it. Smaller games, I'll say.
And like Hades, a bunch of those.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, okay, but that's the question. Did Supermassive really need to do early access as a method for funding? Because they did pretty well with their previous games.
That's a broader discussion, but yeah.
Absolutely. Well, if you're paying your people well and you have a, and you have a budgeting plan that factors in, okay, we're going to release this game, it's going to make this much money. And like, I truly believe early access sales were built into their budget.
Yeah.
And that's, as to a pay, that's to pay everyone a fair salary.
Excuse me, that's Super Giant. Supermassive is a different thing.
It's
Super Giant, different. You're right.
But compared to getting funding, like VC funding or private investment or something, I think it totally makes more sense to be like, hey, just help us crowdfund this thing. We've seen Kickstarters and other things being used to act, not just make a project actually happen, but to help build a project as they're moving. I have to say, part of that though, it's like, it is sort of like you're building a plane as you're trying to take it, you know, take it off as you're trying to lift off. So there are potential issues around that. I mean, I'm seeing from people who are playing Baldur's Gate 3 that the subsequent chapters are less polished than chapter one, which they have spent years refining. And like, people who've done the end game for that say like, it's not as good as like when it began. So I feel like they'll just continue to polish it over time, and maybe overall that'll be a more cohesive narrative all the way through. That seems like a problem though, if you're playing the game right now, or maybe a disappointment.
Or maybe it's just a platform for DLC down the line. You know, it's like, but I agree that, hey, if you're releasing a game, it should be the best you can offer all the way through. Absolutely.
It would be nice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It would be nice.
So getting back to the idea of building the plane while you're flying it, or flying the plane while you're building it, or however you want to say, this is something that I'm super curious about. Jess, do you have any insight into whether or not like games in early access crunch less, or is it all crunch?
No. So like, crunch isn't inherent in this industry, right? It's something that studios choose to do, and it's something that a lot of AAA studios have gotten used to, which is why it's so endemic. But especially smaller studios generally have better workflows. There's definitely crunch in indie studios, but the ownership is different over the game. The people building on these smaller teams actually generally have more ownership over what they're actually building, and they care a little more about the writing they're doing because they're the only one writing it, or they're the only one making that asset, or they're the only one that thought of that mechanic, and they were actually allowed to put it in the game instead of being shot down by Todd Howard. Okay, I don't know what Todd Howard did on Starfield, to be fair, but there are, I would love, by the way, just to go back to Starfield for one second, if someone is playing, every time you see a character that looks like Todd Howard, just take a screenshot. Make an X thread or whatever. Like, I need to see all the Todd Howards in Starfield because there are so many. It was ridiculous. Okay. Either way.
There were other problems with Starfield too. I believe like one of the collaborators passed away who had been working on the game, like passed away, I think, before the release of the game too. So I don't know like how much energy and how much that hurt the team and everything going on there, but yeah, man. There are issues. Yeah.
One would think that the loss of even a critical developer would not keep a game from having a complete lack of point of view.
Except they were a creative lead. So it's like, well. Mm.
But the more direct comparison, now that we're getting off of Baldur's Gate, but I want to talk about early access a little bit more. If you've been in development for this long, how do you not have a point of view? We're making the comparison between Starfield and the Outer Worlds. It's all point of view. It's a very political game. How do you not have any kind of even like attempt at politics in this huge game? Well, actually, I answered my own question. It's a huge game, and maybe they're trying to please everyone.
I think that that's ultimately it. Like, the goal is to make big game make money, make big game, and also rather than say anything clearly.
Then you have streamers screeching about how you can use gender-neutral pronouns.
I know.
I love it.
But one thing I will say Starfield does well is there are a ton of women in leadership positions. there's representation of gay people, there's representation of people of color, but it's like, especially seeing all the women in leadership, I was like, oh, sweet, I'm in a boardroom full of women CEOs. I'm liking this future. That's fine. Thank you, Starfield.
Let's get back to talking about early access for just a second. So Baldur's Gate 3, I think one of the things that people talked about is, wow, we're treating the official release as the official release. And apparently there is something in the culture of games that's like, oh, well, don't release something in early access because it's people are going to assume that that's just the way it's going to be forever. And so I'm curious if this is, now we need an addendum to the adage from the Nintendo executive that said a delayed game is eventually good, but a bad game or a rushed game is bad forever.
It's not true. It's not true anymore. And it hasn't been true for a while since developers have been able to roll out day one patches with their games. It's day one patches followed by 1.03. You know, it's just like, I think No Man's Sky got it right. They released a game. They had something there. And that could have been an early access release, absolutely. But it worked as a full release because that was the idea. They got people to pay for it. They were able to polish up exactly what they needed to. And now we have a great world to play in.
I could see the timeline where No Man's Sky did the early access thing. But let's not forget, like, what happened is, like, No Man's Sky basically had a publishing deal with Sony. And it was really Sony being out there being like, Sony being Sony. It's like when we talked about the Gran Turismo movie, gotta market this, gotta like fuel this to 11.
Too much.
This game is the
too
most
much.
Incredible thing you've ever seen. You've got millions of worlds and possibly like, it's insane. You can do anything with this game. And No Man's Sky got so much buzz that it couldn't possibly live up to that at launch. And I think that's a whole other thing. We don't really see that happen to too many other games. Maybe Cyberpunk was like partially that too.
And I think Cyberpunk seems to have ingoodened in a similar way.
Yep. Cyberpunk has ingoodened. I would also argue Cyberpunk had a lot of good stuff at launch. But the narrative for a lot of people was that if you're playing on console, it stinks. And I wasn't playing on console. I was playing on PC. And there's a lot of good writing and a lot of good stuff in there.
I was shocked. Well, I reviewed it for us and my review was like, yeah, it's worth the wait because I didn't have any of those issues and I liked it. Like, it's a pretty good story. You know, it's fine. It was felt good. Like, what do you want?
Yeah. That was certainly a problem. Like, I think all the criticism against Cyberpunk at the beginning are totally valid, but it did people lose sight of like the good that was actually there. And it does seem like that game has kind of jumped up a lot. I think it's improved quite a bit, but the conversation has moved on because so many things happen. We're always on to the next thing. So another thing in games is it's really hard to go back and like, you know, focus on things that we missed.
And it's still shitty to make people play full price for a broken game.
Yes, absolutely shitty.
That's the sort of thing that takes UGC, as the marketing people say, to bring people back to a game that's already out and that we should be revisiting. But that is just a real dice roll on culture. Like, I don't think that you can really astroturf something like that, especially because gamers are very savvy when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. So in summation and in conclusion, Starfield, there are better versions of it. Go play Baldur's Gate, especially if you love D&D, especially if you love romanceable NPCs. Oh, goodness, it seems like there are a lot of them.
You could do a lot of that. I will say, though, for Game Pass users, if you've already played Outer Worlds and Outer Wild, which a lot of people have, then I do think Starfield is worth a look. Just be like, You gotta cross a lot of garbage to get to the good stuff. But I do think there are some cool, worthwhile things in there. I'm just disappointed that, you know, the narrative is so boring. Like, it doesn't quite make it worthwhile to get there. So we've got Starfield, and we're gonna be talking about a bunch of things we've been playing as well. But this seems like a pretty big week news-wise for games too. There was a report going around from Eurogamer and others that Nintendo has been showing off the Switch 2 to developers at Gamescom. What was that, last week or just last month? We're also hearing reports that, you know, the very important developers who would need to be making Switch 2 games already have dev kits. And there aren't really many details beyond that. It seems like it is a souped-up Switch. It is a more powerful Switch. It is still a portable console hybrid type of thing. We just don't really have any ideas. We're expecting it to maybe launch in late 2024. It could potentially come earlier, but I just wanted to check in with you, Jess, because you are a gaming reporter. Do you think it's about time for a Switch 2? What would you like to see in a Switch follow-up?
Yeah, I mean, all of this tracks from what we know of Nintendo, right? They follow their own schedule. They're always releasing consoles on the off years, and it works out really well for them. Their consoles generally offer something completely unexpected, right? Or something, some new innovation that people
are
like,
for better or worse,
oh, that's weird. Yeah, and then it turns out being the standard, of course. Yeah, so the Switch 2, though, sounds a bit like, it's like the Tears of the Kingdom of consoles for Nintendo. It's going to be the same thing, but better. The same thing, but a little bigger, souped up. Yeah, like you said, I
can't believe them. If the first thing was one of the best games ever made of all time, yes, just make it a little better. I will play that again, you know? So.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild that Nintendo finally figured that out, even with their, like, their software, right? Like, they've never really done a sequel like Tears of the Kingdom in terms of, like, just really doing the same thing but a little different.
Yeah, even Majora's Mask was, like, a very different game, a very different type of game. Yeah.
And that's what they do with their stuff. So, yeah, this is – but I'm actually really excited about the Switch, too. Yeah,
I mean, it's been I remember this all so distinctly because I covered the Switch launch at Engadget, but I also remember covering the Wii U launch at other places I've worked. And that was like, what, 2012? And I do remember just entering this mode and being like, oh, this is a disaster. It is very weird to see a company like Nintendo being like, oh, yeah, guys, we got all this stuff. You got this big tablet. People like tablets now. Look at the iPad. Tablet for your games. OK, how about that? And I do remember trying to talk to Nintendo people at the time, being like, this is insane. This thing is too big. They wouldn't confirm the battery life at the time. It was like less than 2 hours. Like there were so many. I was like, it's like you're seeing a car crash gonna happen. You're like, you know, oh, this car is like 50 feet away. You could avoid this. You could just like avoid this crash entirely. But it's Nintendo. And they're like, no. We know best. So I do think like Nintendo is not infallible. I also loved the GameCube, but I think the GameCube had a lot of problems too, including that goddamn controller. They're kind of like, they're a fascinating company though, because they can, very much like Apple, they do their own thing and they do what they want, and often their impulses are creative rather than market driven. And I do appreciate that in a company like Nintendo. Even if we get a straight up Switch successor, like, hey, I'm still playing the Switch right now. I'm playing Tears of the Kingdom on an OLED Switch, and it looks amazing. And the things people can get running on the Switch.
It looks amazing. It looks, you can see the textures a little bit better.
You can see the textures.
Screen.
It looks amazing. Like, I'm also playing Tears of the Kingdom on my 120-inch screen via projector. And you know what? The stylization of this game, even though it's running at 30 FPS, style-wise, it still looks better than a lot of the generic open-world games we're getting these days, too. Like, Nintendo just knows how to eke the most it can from this hardware. When it comes to the Switch 2, like, yeah, people are just going to buy a more powerful Switch. I would love for them to just call it the Super Switch.
I think that would be cute, actually.
That would be cute, I think they have learned, especially after the Wii U naming confusion, like, maybe don't mess with it. Maybe just, like, some people Switch are two. Very dumb, and also it's parents and grandparents buying things for their grandkids. So, like, you got to be
super.
You gotta be
Switch
clear.
Is easy to get into your head.
I don't know. I don't know if it is. I don't. As somebody
some
who's
testing.
Yeah, we'll yeah. Do, I'm now, sure they're doing a lot of testing.
Yeah, they're absolutely doing market research right
but,
now.
But yeah. Wii U was very confusing for a lot of people, yes. And just in my experience helping people in IT, like, it is very hard to get some things across if it's not like very specific. This is the sequel to this thing that existed before. But anyway, it does seem like this will likely be a portable. I think that's totally fine. Are there features missing? Like, it's going to be faster, obviously. It's going to do better graphics. Are there things you'd like to see in a Switch follow-up, Jess?
Yes. Only because I am still holding out for the Vita that will never come back.
Oh,
I want a rear touchpad. I want a rear touchpad, Nintendo. Give me something weird for my back fingers to do. Yeah. That's all I want.
I see.
I don't know. That's weird enough
Jess
for me.
As the only member of the rear touchpad club, just there alone.
I loved that thing. Are you kidding? It wasn't anything when you weren't using it. And then for some games, you could make like little bubbles pop up. You could control games, things. You could like, pop a balloon. It was great.
It was cool. It was a cool idea. I don't.
No. Okay.
I don't
that's
know.
Not. That's not it. All right. Well,
that's not really. I'm thinking more like. What can we do with this form factor, right? We can still have a very powerful game, like portable gaming system, which, by the way, look at the Steam Deck, look at like what's happening with PC gaming portables right now. But we could also have this thing like maybe be more powerful when stocked. Maybe have that dock be more than a dumb, you know, little output feed for the console itself. The Switch does get a little more powerful when stocked, but I'm thinking we could probably like jack that up even more. There are features people
were you talking about like external graphics cards or something
no,
like that?
It doesn't have to be an external graphics card, but it could be something like that. Just like a little extra power to unlock the people are talking about, like could be DLSS or something like that. NVIDIA's upscaling technology. That chip doesn't need to work while it's in portable mode, or like that capability can just sit quiet. But if you dock it and you trigger it, and it's like, okay, we're going to do like, you know, upscaling to 4K. Don't render in 4K. My God, I wish would just stop doing that. That was the trade-off for Starfield, by the way. They decided to go for 4K 30 FPS when you could get higher frame rates if you don't, you know, people don't need all that resolution. You could do something like that with a docked Switch. Maybe some games could also use the old Switch. I think there are things like there could be some cross compatibility there, because we see how far the Switch hardware can actually last. Like the next Mario Kart, maybe there's a severely downscaled version that works on the original Switch or something like that. Talk about a game that has existed forever, by the way. Mario Kart 8 launched on the Wii U.
Still playing.
Still thriving. They just launched a new bundle with Mario Kart 8. This is Nintendo. They don't have to play anybody else's game.
That's right.
So anyway. Well, yeah.
Building off of that a little bit, one feature I would like to see is reliable cloud streaming capabilities. Mm-hmm. Nintendo just needs to figure out that network thing. Yeah, exactly. They need something to kind of, because the Switch is a perfect cloud streaming machine. So they just kind of need to lean into the stuff that's already working.
Buy a Switch Lite for the same price as the PlayStation Portal and play actual games on it and stream from the cloud. You can't even do that on the PlayStation Portal.
Isn't that wild?
Damn you, Sony. Yeah. These are the things that get me really, really annoyed. Okay, let's move on to a couple of games we've been playing. Jess, I saw you wrote down a couple. You want to start us off here?
I did, yeah. So I messed around a little bit with Remnant 2. And this is that like infinite loop kind of game. It honestly just makes me want to play Returnal.
Returnal. Yeah.
Dude, Returnal's great. And I still boot it up every now and then. So Remnant 2 gets a mid recommendation from me. But the one that I am excited about is Viewfinder. And this is this like very chill, casual game, very pretty indie situation. Where you take photos to manipulate the landscape, and you take a photo and it becomes real in the world, and you can walk across whatever bridge you just did, or you can like take bits out of the scene and move them. It's a cool puzzle game, very pretty. I've had a lot of fun with it. So if you need something to chill with, that's a good one.
Something to chill with. I'm just trying to think. There was
Superliminal, I think, is what you're thinking about, because I'm thinking about Superliminal. I've seen some videos of Viewfinder, and it really does seem like this is inspired, maybe a spiritual successor to Superliminal.
Stylistically a little different, but I see it.
Let me see here. I've been playing a couple of things too, like Sea of Stars. I'm sure you've heard about it, Jess. Like this is the RPG this indie RPG that is very Chrono Trigger inspired, and whenever somebody's like, yeah, our RPG is a little bit like Chrono Trigger. You could apply that to like 20 games at this point. But I think this is the first one that I've seen. It was like, oh yeah, yeah, I see. I directly see your inspiration here. And also it's trying to be a little better because it's an RPG featuring two characters with a battle system that is very Mario RPG-esque too. Like it's a little active. You can hit buttons to do extra hits. You can hit, you know, time buttons to defend a little better. Story-wise, it seems fine, but I think the overall vibe of it is really cool, and the artwork is incredible too. So I've been playing this with my daughter, who we've been like sitting and playing some games together before bedtime. I know that's not ideal screen time-wise, but it's like what the time has just really allowed us for. So we've been playing Dave the Diver, which is really good, but Sea of Stars is the other one where she's getting into the art and the mechanics, and like she's just like liking the experience. This is a great game to play together with your kid. I also want to shout out Sprawl. Have you heard of Sprawl, Jess?
No, I can't say I have.
This was one that I saw climbing the boards on Steam. Like sometimes I look to see like what is a new game that people are really jumping onto. Sprawl is this sort of like It is a hectic FPS. I forget the exact name for that. Like, it is very frenzy FPS, similar to Doom 2016 or earlier games, done in like a Quake 2, Quake 3-ish art style. But it's a lot of fun. Just like you go around shooting stuff, the mechanics feel good, the movement feels good, the shooting is fantastic, great soundtrack. So if you miss like old school FPS stuff and you've got a gaming PC, maybe even a Steam Deck, this will probably run pretty well on the Steam Deck. Sprawl is worth a play for sure. Ben, I know you've been waiting to talk about this, but you have started Armored Core 6. I've also started Armored Core 6. You're probably a little further along than I am, but what are your feelings about the Big Mechs?
Getting the robot 6-2-1.
Getting the robot, Shinji. Yeah.
So I don't care about Armored Core spoilers at all. I don't care about playing this game correctly. I have not gotten to Baltus yet. I'm playing this intermittently. I'm also playing this at my partner's house. So you know what? I have to pay attention to them. You know, I have to pay attention to my girlfriend in order to, have the continued access to
PS5. You can't be fully unleashed with your giant mech love here.
Yeah. Yes, yes. On top of that, we're also like getting ready for a trip next week. But that's another thing. So yes, I've been playing in and out. I am, let's say, maybe like halfway through the first chapter, maybe a little bit further through the first chapter, and I am loving it because each one of these missions in the early game is you just go in, you be an absolute menace, and you leave.
And it feels good because you're a big robot that can move fast when you need to, and you got a laser sword, and you can customize as much as you want. It's fantastic.
The customization is incredible. I really like spending 15 minutes being like, should I use that head or that head? You know, okay, so this targeting chip is a little bit better. I have a lot of fun with that. I was saying before in the kind of like Armored Core preview episode a couple weeks ago that someone told me that this was like Gran Turismo, but mm-hmm. for mechs. That sells it to me. I really like the tinkering aspect of those sorts of games. At the same time, the politics of this game are scary. The world that is happening, or like,
it's a very bleak and cynical game.
It is an extremely bleak and cynical game. You live
in a cynical world, folks. Yeah.
You are like part of a bunch of mercenaries on this planet Rubicon trying to get their unobtainium, which in this game is called Coral. You are like working for this company and then in one mission and then working against that same company from the previous mission in the next mission. You are absolutely a hired gun. No one is nice to you in this game. They all call you dog. You're basically a soldier meat, that's all you are. Yeah, you're basically an indentured servant / slave, but I'm still having a lot of fun with it.
It's one of the... I think like it's from software. It is the, you know, it's the folks who were doing the Souls people stuff. And those games aren't very hopeful. You know, like there's a lot of like a lot of cynicism about humanity and where we are as a culture there. But yeah, I'm feeling that too, Ben. I think that is very purposeful. I think it is definitely trying to talk about having a point of view, something that Starfield doesn't really feel like it has, although it's not like that game totally shies away from politics either. It's just kind of fascinating to see this. So, Ben, you're digging it. Would you recommend it to somebody who's never played an Armored Core before?
I've never played an Armored Core before. I'm having a lot of fun. Like I said, you need to go in with the idea that what you are interested in is being a giant robot.
Why would you buy the giant robot game if you don't want to be a giant robot?
But what I'm saying is that I have no... Like, I have very little interest in, like, get good at this mm-hmm. game. Mm-hmm. I will fully cheese some of the harder bosses. I will look up builds that people used to get through this. Because what I'm just trying to do is get to the next part of being an absolute menace of a giant robot.
I mean, whatever it takes. It's from software. So, yeah. Yeah, they're known for dropping an early boss that really challenges your skill level. Because if you didn't learn the basics, like, we set it up, we showed you all how parrying works. So if you didn't get it, you're screwed. You just do not get past this boss. So it seems like I have not gotten there yet in this game. Although I know a lot of people had trouble with the first big boss from the first mission, like the giant helicopter thing. And it's like, maybe I just watched too much Gundam. You know, I was like, I was not afraid to be like, I'm going to laser sword your butt. That's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to like zoom in there because I think a lot of people were trying to dodge missiles and play defensively. I'm like, no. I've got a laser sword. I can boost right to you and sword you in the face. And that seemed to work pretty well.
Well, that's the thing with the Souls game. Like, you can't just be dodging. You have to be attacking too. And like, that's the challenge. And that's the part that's like, that keeps me away from playing Souls games. I'm not one of those people that wants to do the same fight 20 times to get it right. I'm more like Ben. I might cheese a few. But no, Armored Core sounds cool. Yeah,
It sounds cool. I think you would dig it, Jess. But also, I feel like, have you done Elden Ring yet? Because I feel like you would be down with the Elden Ring.
I did a little bit, but it's just not for me. Like, if you compare Armored Core and the mech battles there to like D.Va from Overwatch, for me, I might be able to grab onto that a little more.
If you want to fully customize your D.Va, then yeah, this is
the
game for
too.
You.
I really do.
So as a final thought with Armored Core, I want to shout out a article in Polygon by the editor-in-chief, Chris Plant. The title is Struggling with Armored Core 6? Do the coolest thing possible. The first line of this article is, two things can be true. I am bad at Dark Souls games. I beat Armored Core 6. And then it goes into talking about how the key to playing Armored Core is to do the most cool cinematic thing possible.
That'll probably help you
get through the game.
Yes.
That's so great. What a great game. And what a great game that, like, that's the conclusion that we come to. That's perfect. That's a that's a focused design right there, folks.
That's a focused design. That's also something when I used to play tabletop RPGs, that used to get me in trouble because some DMs did not want to see that. But, you know, I think that is a good philosophy for gaming in general. So, listen, this was a great episode to have you on, Jess, because we got to wrap up some of this stuff. There's a lot of game stuff coming. You know, we still have some major titles coming this year. Is there anything you're super excited for, or are you just like clearing your backlog at this point?
Oh, no, there's plenty coming. I'm allowed to say that I'm playing Forza Motorsport, the first 90 minutes of that game. So we'll have a little preview on Monday, actually.
How much menu tinkering is in that one?
You'll have to read my preview to find out. I think you'll be happy, though. And then Alan Wake 2 is the next one that I am personally interested in. That's coming in October, so I'll be reviewing that as well.
Time to play that remake, which is on Game Pass, I believe.
Yeah, seriously.
So, yeah,
go
seriously.
For it.
All right, thank you, Jess. Let's move on to some other news, and we're just going to bounce real quickly here because we spent a lot of time talking about games. But hey, the Pixel 8 Pro leaked again. And this was right on Google's site, showing off Google's own 360-degree simulator. And as we said last week, it really does seem like Google is just leaking this stuff to get any sort of buzz, as we are days away from Apple's next iPhone event. And Google has done this in years past, and it seems like it's happening again. Jess, do you think this is a great marketing tactic? Just spoiling your opponent's events ahead of time, I guess?
I guess. I mean, do they think that we think it's real, like that it's actually
some
leaking? Do they think they're
real,
being sneaky?
Yeah.
I guess so. I guess maybe, yeah, people who just see it pop up, they're like, oh, okay, it leaked. It's very transparent, right? So
I think
I guess
by
it's
this
working,
point,
whatever.
Yeah, even the teens eager for phone leaks, which, do they still exist? I don't know. This is not the same as it was 10 years ago. But even those folks are like, yeah, we get it, Google. Come on. Just kind of hilarious. Like, I do think it is getting a little desperate from Google's part, but hey, it looks like a Pixel 8. It has the bar, it has more cameras. There were other like leak details. I think past leaks said it has a 50 megapixel main camera with 50% more light capabilities. It can let in more light, and a 64 megapixel ultra wide Sony camera. So big cameras on that big metal band on the back. Otherwise, it looks like a Pixel phone. So I don't think Google is stretching themselves design-wise here. So yeah, we will be hearing more about that in early October when that Google event hits. Also in the news, if you're in New York, you may be noticing that Airbnb is basically being cut out of the city pretty much. There's been a long-term battle between the city of New York and Airbnb when it comes to having people rent out their apartments or having people just you know, landlords who decided to turn some of their apartments into Airbnb rentals. A lot of people have said, and the city's argued, like, this is basically contributing to the housing crisis in New York. Like, rents were already too high. Airbnb is pushing it higher because people can make more money with short-term rentals versus long-term rentals. So anyway, as of this week, there are new rules enforced in New York. And if you are looking for an Airbnb in New York City, your options are probably going to be very, very limited. Airbnb hosts will have to register with the city. They will have to be present on the property. So that's more likely meant for owners of a building or owners of a townhouse or something that have an extra room for people. They can only rent out to two guests at a time. And what else? I mean, those are kind of the basic things. Typically, when people choose an Airbnb, they want to treat it like a hotel. And you probably won't be able to do that. Do you have any feelings? Like, Ben, you are close to New York. So
yeah, as the only New York renter in this chat right now, I am of two minds on it. Because hotels in the New York City area are ridiculously expensive. And you better believe that the hotel lobby was big behind this Airbnb ban.
This is great for hotels.
So, big question is the enemy of my enemy my friend? Is this going to open up more whole apartments for long-term renters? And man, is it just so complicated. Every time people talk about housing policy in this city, it's, you know, should it be denser? Should it be that certain regulations be loosened in order to make it easier for really old, dilapidated apartment units that are not currently occupied to be updated and then occupied?
It's a mess. Airbnb, like, this was a disaster, so...
Yeah, I can't parse all of it. The only thing I can do is advocate the Engadget listeners in New York City to support Councilperson Chai Osei's measure to make landlords pay broker's fees and put a cap on broker's fees in New York City, because this is crazy.
I have paid so many broker's fees. It's awful. Yeah.
Also, because this is a podcast, I need to mention that Chai Osei is the son of legendary podcaster Reggie Combat Jack Osei. R.I.P. Okay.
Wow. We are already at a point where we have like a spawn of legendary podcasters. So, wow. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
The second generation of podcasters. Second generation.
Yeah.
Jeez,
but anyway, let me just say, like, I was booking, I have to cover the Surface event in New York. So I was looking for a place to stay. Hotels that week, thanks to Fashion Week, were all $600 plus a night. Everything in Manhattan. So I found an Airbnb in my old neighborhood. It is apparently a Kingdom Hearts super fans Airbnb because there's like keyblades on the wall and stuff. They designed it to be like a Kingdom Hearts room. I was like, okay, I can work in the Kingdom Hearts room. I won't die here. Yeah, that's where I'm staying for the Surface event. But I guess I'm happy that I'm able to do that. And I hope that person wasn't like taking away an apartment from somebody else. But it's complicated. Staying in New York, bringing a family to New York. My family and I stayed at one floor of an owner's building a couple of months ago, too. And that was a good experience. But, you know, I don't know. I don't fully know like how that deals with the New York housing issues. Also, as somebody who lived there for a decade, yeah, these problems existed for so much longer before Airbnb. But anyway, let's talk about some gadgets. The UE Epic Boom. Logitech announced the UE Epic Boom, which is a new wireless speaker that falls between the Mega Boom and the Hyper Boom. You guys may remember the Hyper Boom because that was the like $450 thing, giant party speaker from Logitech. And I love that thing. It's super loud, sounds great. The Epic Boom is $350. It is kind of like a double Mega Boom, it looks like, according to photos and hands-ons from John Turi at Engadget. So it weighs about 4.3 pounds. It's $350, which I think is a lot, especially compared to the next speaker we're going to be talking about. But hey, I really like Logitech's UE speakers. If you want something that is powerful and very versatile and functional, this is definitely one worth checking out. But also, this week, Sonos announced the Move 2 speaker. And this is the second version of their portable speaker. This is going to be $450. But the big difference is it has double the battery life as the last model. And also, it has two tweeters. So it's basically stereo sound in a little box. We have not heard this yet. It sounds very cool. I have the original Sonos Move that I got on sale, and I love that thing because it can be a great speaker in my family room, and then I can bring it to the backyard and can fill the entire backyard with like enough sound. So great for parties and stuff too. Samsung also unveiled their largest 8K TV yet. It is a 98-inch model. The Neo QLED 8K will likely cost around $10,000. I'm just saying this as a PSA. People do not buy 8K TVs. I don't know why these companies are still making 8K TVs, and I still see them being sold in some places, but literally no reason to buy an 8K TV. The content is not there. They're all relying on AI upscaling to maybe see slightly better quality than 4K. But by all accounts, your eyes will not see it. So go OLED, go mini LED, go literally anything else but these 8K TVs.
Can I ask you,
yeah,
since you know this space, who is buying an 8K TV? Is it just a bunch of rich people? Yeah. Is anyone buying 8K TV? I don't even know.
I have not seen the stats. Yeah. I'm sure there are some market research out there. I have not done that digging yet. I think maybe rich people and people with too much money, and maybe somebody who's like, oh yeah, I'm going to make the ultimate theater room. I'm going to be ready for 8K. And good on you for trying to be future-proof, but it's not worth the money, especially when the content is not there. And we don't even know if these 8K TVs will be compatible with like future stuff you'll actually need in an 8K set. My thing is, I'm just going to say it because it's always good to say this on tech shows. I don't know if we'll ever really need 8K in the home. It does not make sense when 4K is more than sharp enough for the vast majority of screen sizes. Like, not until you go above 120 inches will you really see that difference with 8K. So, yeah, I don't know if it's super necessary. We've got some other news, too, a little more serious news. Let me see here. Mozilla had a really great report as part of their Privacy Not Included project that explains why cars are data privacy nightmares. So that's worth reading. It just seems like car companies are tracking all sorts of things, including your gender and potentially sexual habits. We don't know how they're getting this information. Even if you're not doing stuff in the car, like they have access to things. I don't know what that means. Go read the Mozilla report, because it's not clear how they're getting some of this information, but it may be like you being targeted for other ads, if they're able to detect that through their apps or something.
If you travel to a certain area of town, that's the only thing it can I don't understand.
Don't
I'm very
know.
Suspicious of my RAV4 now. I don't like this.
I think, Well.
Is there going to be like some car version of physiognomy where they assume that like a larger bottom with a slightly higher body temperature might be male? Driving around your bros, are they going to assume some things about your sexuality?
They're getting cameras,
of course.
They're getting cameras in, they're getting infrared to like detect like if your eyes are actually on the road. So as a part of that, I don't know, like the thing is like we don't know, these companies aren't doing anything with this actual data, but there may be some data that they're collecting. We're not sure if this stuff is encrypted. We're not sure what's happening with it. It just seems like car companies are very bad about gathering this data in terms of like storing it and handling it. So something to keep an eye out for. Probably right now it's not going to make a difference in terms of like which car company you support. But yeah, just be careful what you sign into when you get a new car.
So the US is also kicking off its first monopoly trial against Google. So Dev, you were the expert on this. You've read a bunch of articles about this. Is this where the rubber meets the road for Lina Khan's philosophy of monopoly means that you're touching too many things?
I mean, it is. I think they're kind of testing it. This is not coming through the FTC. This is the Department of Justice. But it is a very similar thing, right? Like, so the case here is that over the past several years, the US government has been trying to make the case that Google, by making deals with Apple and other companies to place itself within their services and their operating systems, that was basically turning Google into a monopoly. And because of that, like, they had abused their platform by doing so. I don't know if the case from the government here is very, very strong, is the thing, because this is not like when the US government was going after Microsoft in the 90s for saying, you're just putting my Internet Explorer front and center, and you're making it kind of tough for other browsers just to survive. The big deal was the Internet Explorer was free and baked into Windows 95 and 98, and Netscape Navigator, you had to pay for. People don't remember this, but Netscape was like $30. I do remember this. And even before that, it was Mosaic. But you had to pay for it, and basically by having a free browser, Microsoft killed the browser market completely. They went to trial. They were found guilty of that. And like there were all sorts of things Microsoft had to do, right? Microsoft, it took a decade before the actual repercussions actually happened, but I believe they paid a huge fine. And they also had to have this like selector pop up, especially in Europe, I believe. But they had to have a selector pop up that made you aware that other browsers were available and basically help you get to those other browsers. That was way too late. That was after Chrome was out there and actually started taking things over. It was after Firefox was out there, the sort of successor to Netscape and Mozilla's stuff. So, yeah, I don't know if the government has a strong case here, but we're going to be watching it. This is a 10-week trial. There is no jury here. So it's also going to all depend on the judge's judgment at the end of this in terms of what happens to Google. But things like this is where in the 80s, AT&T was broken up into several smaller companies because they were found to be too powerful and too dominant in this field. I think Google search still accounts for 90% of the search market. We don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if search is necessarily the best thing to fight Google against, too. There is a separate suit from the government against Google's ad business, which I think
the ad case is a lot stronger.
That may be more dangerous, yeah, for Google. Definitely.
And I've heard so many things about how Facebook and Google eat up something crazy like, please don't quote me on this, but it could be like $3 of every $4 on the online ad market. It's ridiculous. And this is part of what has been killing like independent websites. It's because you can't make money on banner ads. You can't make money on a lot of the more traditional way of advertising. That's why you're seeing so many editorial websites especially go the wire cutter route and try to make money through Amazon affiliate links.
Yep. And full disclosure, like we are doing that too with some of our product recommendation posts. So that's a thing you need to do to survive on the internet. I do wonder how this is going to affect things like Google, like YouTube, because I do think YouTube has such a dominant hold on us as a culture. There aren't really many other like popular video sites, like maybe TikTok, if you're looking for Vimeo, a different type of experience. Yeah. But in terms of like, hey, you want to produce like a nice looking show, Vimeo's kind of died. We had talked about that a couple months ago.
It has. I
could see the government being like, okay, well, allow other advertisers into YouTube that aren't part of your platform. Allow that to happen because you are so powerful here. There's no way for anybody else to ever make a competing video format or video site that's as big as this. So there could be things like that happening. And I think some of that is warranted. Like Google has had unchecked success for so, so long. And the government has not really been in a place to really stop it or do anything about it. So anyway, we'll be following this trial. Stay tuned. Ben, you dropped this news from 404 Media, by the way. I just want to shout out like those folks. Those are the former Motherboard Vice technology site folks who splintered off and basically have started a media co-op. 404 Media, check them out. I think is it 404media.co? Not .com, but you could pretty much all their stories are like really cool and interesting. And the one you highlighted here is that they have found that an AI 3D modeling company, Kaidem, is using human artists to generate output and not just its magical AI tool, right?
Yeah, so this gets into a personal theory I've had, which is that there are going to be a lot of quote-unquote AI companies in the next couple of years that are literally just going to be Mechanical Turks. Mechanical Turk being that thing from a long time ago when someone said that they made a machine that will just play chess. This is long before the computers. But it turns out that there was just some guy hiding inside the machine making the chess moves.
I always like that story, by the way. But yeah.
So similar thing, you can just use AI as a curtain and then say, don't look behind that curtain. That's proprietary code, and hide a bunch of actual people. So this company said that it was going to take 2D drawings and make them into 3D models in 15 minutes or less. And the company's actual tech produced 3D models that were like really low quality and just kind of like digital clay blobs, basically. So they started hiring quality assurance engineers, and they were hiring them from all over the world. One, so that they didn't have to pay all that much, and two, so they could have 24/7 on-call folks to fix Kaidem's messed up 3D renders. 404 Media found LinkedIn profiles of folks working from Kaidem in Argentina, England, Indonesia, Ethiopia, India, Greece, the Czech Republic, Colombia, Spain. That's a lot. One source claimed that Kaidem hired 3D artists around the world and paid them as much as $1 to $4 per model from users that requested them. And so this was corroborated later on by another job post for a freelance 3D artist at Kaidem, and they were looking for applicants that could produce low-quality 3D assets from 2D images in 15 minutes, like literally just saying the quiet part out loud. After this article was published, Kaidem's website changed some of their verbiage, saying that there would be humans helping out. It just feels bad to me.
It feels bad. I do want to say a couple of things here. I do think in every AI startup, and even when we use AI for stuff like transcription, like you gotta go in and fix the issues. So like I have to go in and like edit words, and things are misconstrued when I do. I use Word Online's AI transcription, which works pretty well. If you have a good quality audio, check it out, folks. I even wrote an article about it in Gadget. But every company has to do this sort of assurance. The question is, how much of the work was from these humans versus the actual AI model? And we need to see more. I'd love to hear this company actually fully respond to this, because it seemed like they were just kind of brushing off 404 at this point, right?
Well, and it's like, it's not even that different from like USA Today recently had to update a bunch of articles, like high school sports scores and stuff, because all these were AI generated and they were filled with errors. Like, this is something we've seen time and time again, right?
Yeah, they were not.
They're also boring, and they're not well written. And as you said, like, even transcription, I use Otter AI transcription, which is also very good. You can record, you know, live audio, and it transcribes it right in front of your face. It's awesome. But yes, it's filled with errors, and it just totally misses the point sometimes. And it says the opposite.
It has so many problems with homophones.
You have to go through it. Yes, it really does. Absolutely. Yeah.
So the really galling thing about this is that so many of these companies can say, quote unquote, AI, then they can say that they have quality control engineers in order to maybe help train their machine learning data set, or to help like grow the data set, when really what they're doing is taking in money from customers, having people do it, and then hoping that eventually their tech will get good enough so that they can lay off the people.
But that's
literally just a like artist for hire company. You're not an AI company until you actually have AI stuff doing.
I don't, and I want to be clear about this story. Like, I think the thing is, this company has funding from VCs. So somebody has had to see the tech actually work, like, before they even had these humans doing it. Not that much funding, to be honest. Like, it's 150,000 euros, so not a ton. They have seed funding at this point. But I think what's happening is people are making like very basic AI models and then slowly improving it with these human things. Because here's the other thing. An AI model doesn't work by magic, right? It is trained upon the data that's already being inputted in there. So part of what they're doing could also be like using these humans fixing these things to make the model better over time. It's still shitty. I just want to be clear about, I'm not saying like, I think we need to be clear. It's not like they may have no algorithm at all. It's most likely just very bad. And also, you're dealing with inputs. Like, is somebody like doing a bad squiggly of a tree and then expecting the AI model to deal with it? Like, that part we don't know. There's so much we don't know here. But this is crummy. This is like, these companies, they got to be more clear about how they're using humans. I think that's the ultimate thing here.
And they can't keep making claims that we know just are not possible with AI at this stage. Like, it's just too obvious, guys. Like, yeah, slow down. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, check out 404 Media. I love these folks. I'm listening to their podcast right now. The top news on their site right now is Andreessen Horowitz funds an uncensored AI that will tell you how to kill yourself. So that's the world we're living in right now, is literally the suicide bots in Futurama. Like, it's horrifying. 44 Media is great. 44media.co. Support those folks if you can, because they're out there on their own, like, just running a media site, which is the dream and kind of cool. So I think it's pretty cool. Yeah. Anything else you want to mention, Ben, about this? Because I know you had a lot of thoughts.
It's just frustrating.
Frustrating. Be wary. Absolutely. Anytime you see AI attached to anything, just, like, you know, red flag. Raise a red flag and be like, oh, so what are you talking about here? What's actually going on? Because usually people will do that to get more funding, to get more users. And we don't know if it's actually a fully baked product.
Ask a lot of clarifying questions about their workflow.
Always. And look them up. Look up, like, before you subscribe to any company, before you start using a product, look up reviews and see the coverage. And I think this sort of coverage is not going to be great for Kaiden. Let's move on to what we're working on. And Jess, anything you want to mention? You already gave us a glimpse at some of your games. Anything else coming?
So Forza Motorsport is coming in hot. And then I'm working on a story about gender in esports. And I think it's a very important conversation. And so hopefully you'll be seeing that on the site this month or in the coming months.
An article that will certainly get you many, many just flowery emails that, of people loving you.
Yeah, no, I'm very used to that. I'm not worried about the trolls, but it's an important enough conversation that I'm willing to ride that wave for a while. Absolutely.
Thank you for that, Jess. Hopefully the guy who got so angry about pronouns in Starfield, the British guy, oh man.
Who's getting divorced, apparently. I wonder why.
Seems like a cool dude. In terms of what I'm working on, I'm finishing up my review of that LG Ultra Gear 49-inch gaming monitor that I was talking about a while ago. I'm also doing the podcast on this right now. It is a very cool gaming monitor, but not all games support ultra widescreen. So Starfield does not. Starfield gives me black borders. You know what game does support fully widescreen? No Man's Sky. Like, pure immersive No Man's Sky. That's always, like, it's just funny how that is working out once again. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Jess, you got anything you want to shout out, like, that you've been reading or watching that you want people to check out?
Yeah, actually, so we did a Hitting the Books the other day, because I sent in to Andy, who does our Hitting the Books series, I sent in this book by Pippin Barr, who is a game developer I've interviewed a few times. He makes these, like, short philosophical, like, Greek mythology based games, but they're very funny. He did one about Marina Abramovich, the artist who just, like, stared at people in the museum for a while. Not just, there's a larger point. I actually thought it was a very poignant piece of art. But he wrote a book. He wrote a book that is basically why we haven't made the Citizen Kane of gaming. And it talks about how games are made from a very basic level. The book is called The Stuff Games Are Made Of. It's pretty short. He's a fun guy, fun writer. So if you can find that somewhere, hitting the books, The Stuff Games Are Made Of,
you can read the segment. Yeah. Read our segment on Hitting the Books, but also check out that book. Sounds very cool. Thank you, Jess. I want to shout out a couple of things. I'm a big fan of Victor Lavelle, the horror writer, and one of his books is being turned into an Apple TV Plus series called The Changeling, starring Lakeith Stanfield. I love Lakeith Stanfield. I love Victor Lavelle. And this is a really fascinating, it's sort of like supernatural fairy tale horror quite a bit, because it is about a disappearing child, but it's also about generations of love and generations of trauma. It is very novelistic in how it kind of goes over the story. Jess, I think you would actually really like this, because it's a beautiful story, and it's about, like, all powerful forces of love and also curses, and also, you know, the power of New York City, which is something I always appreciate, and the power of Lakeith Stanfield, who I think is pretty cool. So yeah, check out The Changeling. It's definitely worth a watch. I think a lot of these Apple TV Plus series have been kind of middling. This one is really, really worth checking out. Also want to shout out Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which is that other Star Trek show, which people don't talk about that much. That's not Discovery, but we've done a couple of reviews here. I just want to say season 2 is incredible, as a lot of people have been saying, especially season 2, episode 2, which deals with a court trial that is just so well done, so well written, so well acted. If you are into Star Trek, or if you're not into Star Trek, I actually think Strange New Worlds is a good jumping off point because you meet a lot of these characters. It's very careful about how it introduces you into this world, and it's a lot of fun. So season 2 of Strange New Worlds is fantastic. Check it out, folks. That's on Paramount Plus.
Thanks for listening. That's all for this week. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. And the podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman.
Hey!
You can find Devendra online at...
I'm still at Devendra on Twitter. I'm at Devendra MS on social. I'm at Devendra at Blue Sky as well.
You can find Jess at...
I am on Threads and Instagram, Jess L. Condit.
And you can find Ben at literally just benelman.wav, that's .wav, at gmail.com. Don't try to find me on the internet. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and listen on literally anything that gets podcasts. Support RSS. Goodbye!
Thanks, folks.